Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 21st, 2005. Today's session is a forum entitled, Can Science and Technology? Should Science and Technology? Facilitated by Paul Olson. Disc number, FO 2005-22.
And I serve the village as the associate to the assistant to the, I think somewhere down the line, to the teaching staff coordinator. But I also, I'm on the teaching staff. And the title of our forum tonight is Science Can, Should Science? And we've got four brief ways to introduce some ideas, and then the whole process will be, we will just share. This isn't a teaching session, it's a share session. It's we don't have experts here, we've got different kinds of people to respond with different kinds of questions, and raise some of the many issues that are there. Grant Thorson is a biology teacher at Willamette University. He's going to participate in helping us introduce this. Dorothy Bass, who is our teaching staff coordinator, will, and our pastor Emily will also just share stories to get us started, and then we will go from there. I'm going to start with something that was in Time magazine just a couple weeks ago. It's called The Last Word. You might have read it by Anna Quindlen. And the title of her essay is Now Available Middle Ground. I'm not going to read the whole essay. I'm going to read a couple sentences. It's about abortion and Plan B. Plan B is a drug used to prevent pregnancy, and nothing about preventing pregnancy in America is simple, except for the fact that so many women do it as a matter of course. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that works by inhibiting ovulation, fertilization, or implantation. It won't work if you're already pregnant, but it will stop you from becoming pregnant if your everyday contraceptive failed or if you've had unprotected sex. But because it must be taken within a few days, it's sometimes called the morning after pill. It's important to have ready access. The moral implications are there. The question ones that we've seen in our culture are there. But I read this to suggest science can. That's one of the things science can do. And Grant has some more things science can do.
Okay. Paul asked me to, he was in my session yesterday, saw a couple of things he asked me to share with you. The first one, I got three slides, if I remember. The main area that we're going to cover on these slides has to do with what's called therapeutic cloning. And therapeutic cloning, it'll get explained as we go through these three slides. I'm going to take probably closer to 2 minutes to do this. First, just so that everybody understands what we mean by a clone, this simple example, historically a very important one, because it was the first cloning of a multicellular organism, and carried out in plants, but basically, done by an individual by name, last name of Stewart in the 1950s, basically took a little plug of tissue from the root of a carrot, the part we eat, teased apart the cells to get them to be single cells. And one thing about plants is that many plants will grow from a single cell of the proper hormones. So he separated them out into single cells, put them into culture dishes, added the right nutrients and hormones to get them, plant hormones, to get them to start to divide, and they would differentiate ultimately through a stage called the callus and all, but where roots start being formed and stem and leaves, so they become differentiated, planting those and producing carrots. Okay, and these carrots are genetically identical to the one he started from. Okay, and this is what we mean by a clone. These are clones of that carrot over there. They are genetically identical to the cells from which they arose, and the carrot from which the cells arose, I should say. Now, this is a fairly simple example. It's used greatly in horticulture, and it's very common in plants. It can be done in animals, and it has been done in animals, taking cells from an animal. Often what we do now is take a nucleus from the cell of an animal and inject and put it into an egg cell that's had its nucleus removed, and then growing those in the laboratory in culture and forming a new individual. I think everybody in this room has probably heard of Dolly and knows articles about Dolly the sheep in 1997, taking a cell from the mammary tissue, the udder of an adult sheep, implanting that into an egg, allowing it to grow like an in vitro fertilization would grow. That's been going on since 78 in humans, where you fertilize an egg and it grows for a little bit in the lab, a few divisions, and then implant it back into the womb to grow. Well, in any case, that was done with the sheep in 1997, and off we are and running. One of the areas that is of interest is something called human therapeutic cloning. You can envision two kinds of cloning in humans. One might be, it has never been done, and I think most people hope it won't be done, is what we call reproductive cloning, to produce a new individual. And that has been done in animals. It's been done in endangered species, and several examples of rabbits and goats and sheep and cows. There are dairy cattle that have been cloned. But so that's reproductive cloning. Therapeutic cloning is to take a patient's, an individual's own tissue as the source material and produce an embryo, not an adult, but an embryo. And if after about 5 days of incubation of in the laboratory, that first cell that was obtained by taking that nucleus and putting it into an unfertilized egg, enucleated egg, after about 5 days, it forms a mass called the blastocyst. Blastocyst is actually the stage that's naturally implanted into the uterus during pregnancy, but it's a spherical mass of cells. And once the spherical mass of cells is formed, a series of cells start forming inside the sphere. And those are called stem cells. The advantage of stem cell is that the stem cell, by proper culture and hormone treatment, can be, not all of this has been done yet, some have, but most of it hasn't, but can be caused to differentiate into different kinds of tissue, into nervous tissue, into muscle tissue, and that could then be utilized to treat, perhaps, Parkinson's disease, or a heart condition where there's death of heart tissue, etc. So that's called therapeutic cloning. It's producing a, it's like doing in vitro fertilization. In fact, you can do it that way to get to this point. In vitro fertilization, allow culture in the laboratory, and then take those cells to treat different conditions. The next slide, if this is what the rest of my colleagues want to do, I'm just going to leave on the screen for us to come back to. And these are a few questions that I came up with that we might want to consider later in the discussion.
Thank you. That's just a brief introduction of a two of many, you know, Plan B in this, of what science can do. And then we've got two illustrations of what perhaps we can question, should science? And Emily and Dorothy both have stories. And whoever wants to go, Emily will.
My dad, I think, was 59 when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And before that, in his college days, he was a great athlete. Did some athleticizing, not in the same sports, with Paul. And coached basketball and baseball for many, many, many years. And was a teacher in the high school. And finally decided that he couldn't teach any longer because it was so distracting for the high school students to watch his left hand shake. They couldn't pay attention to him because his hand would shake, and it was for the maybe more mature students, it was just kind of nerve-wracking, and they were concerned. For the less mature students, it was something to giggle at, and that was hard for him to handle. And had been a greatly respected teacher in that school district as well. So he retired early, partially because it was a little uncomfortable to be teaching and he didn't feel he was as effective as a teacher, and partially because his great pastime is trout fishing in the streams of Upper Michigan. And if he was going to do that, he needed to start doing it now before he turned 65. He couldn't wait to be 65 because he didn't know what condition he'd be in by the time he got to 65 and could retire after a full career. So He retired at the age of 61, I believe, and is doing fine, but his left leg always is trouble. He got stuck in almost quicksand once, and it took him 2 hours to get out because he couldn't lift that left leg fishing alone on the trout stream. We were real happy about that. But he's just becoming more and more debilitated, even though there is medicine to suppress many of the symptoms. It is a progressive disease, so no matter how much they suppress the symptoms now, it will continue to debilitate him. And he doesn't have any grandchildren yet, and that makes my mom very sad that he may not be able to function in any kind of physical capacity once the grandchildren come along and things like that. So we as a family are really hopeful for some kind of medical breakthrough, and stem cell research is one of the ways that that's been happening. And I'm kind of on the fence about ethics in that, so.
Thank you.
Well, I want to tell briefly about my own closest encounter with these technologies, which came about 20 years ago when I was pregnant. I didn't know it, but carrying, there's one of the babies up there, there's John here as well. I didn't know I was carrying twins at that time. But I was almost 37 years old, and therefore was confronted by my doctor with a choice which virtually every woman with access to health care now is confronted with. Do you do prenatal genetic testing? And you know, the chance, and I'm sure it's much more advanced now. Now they can test earlier in a pregnancy, and they can also test for far more conditions. At that time, this was a test on amniotic fluid taken in the 16th, 18th week of pregnancy. And before this pregnancy, I'd married kind of on the late side, and before this, we had struggled with infertility, not as difficult as for some people. We had struggled with this. I had had a miscarriage. And so here now I'm being asked not to commit to this pregnancy, you know, until 18 weeks or so, which seemed just, you know, it was very painful. At the same time, now I should say my husband was very supportive and was with me the whole way, but I'll tell you a little bit about a background. So he was just pretty clear that parenting means being uncertain about some things, and you don't know what's gonna happen, and it didn't grab him, this option didn't grab him as a temptation in the way it did me. But I come from a family of, you know, very sort of well-to-do engineers, my dad, my sister's a surgeon, you know, they were all just really pressing, and from a very liberal East Coast family, they were really pressing me to have this test. And because they believe the technology really is always our friend. And they're kind of from that part of our culture. It was just very hard for me to figure this out. And Mark and I consulted friends a little older than we who had a seriously disabled child who had died before we even met them at the age of 12. And they basically said, you know, we wouldn't make this choice for you at all. This is your choice. If you know, anybody who is worried about that, we would not judge them negatively to test and to end a pregnancy. But at the same time, that child has been our greatest joy. There was that. There was a sense of, you know, very, very much a theological sense for me, finally, that which was more coming to what Mark already was, that in parenthood we do open ourselves to receive all kinds of surprises. If not in birth, then a few years later. So, I just struggled with this it was very painful because it was probably kind of a transition from one family of values to another family of values as well. As soon as I decided not to have the test, I slept great the rest of the pregnancy. Had no second thoughts about it, and did have two healthy children. But it's this kind of choice is even more making conditional the pregnancies of people who who got pregnant today and who have access to health care. A medical establishment is very much, seems to be, you know, sometimes you wonder, on it, is it a campaign to improve, you know, to make sure we don't have to have any burdens? And yet, what would our world be like, what would our society be like if kids were a little different, were just not there, you know, or if we didn't have the privilege of caring for people who are, you know, who need care in that way, and there are many gifts to offer in return. So I think it's a big social question. I confirmed it 20 years ago, but I think that almost every woman who now is pregnant has to do so as well.
Thank you.
Put that other question back on.
Sure. So we've been introduced to what science can do, and then asked the question, what should science do, or how should we use science? And now it's open for you folks to, if you have a story, you can tell it. If you have considerations, obviously there are political ramifications, social, moral, religious, by meaning church structures, as well as questions of just our own Christian faith. So it's wide open for you folks.
Can I ask a question? I have a doctor friend that went to some kind of a seminar, and it kind of blew him away because he said that it was told something about you can live forever, and the man started out by telling about how to stay young, and he made the remark, in this next millennium, if you have enough money, you can live forever. That's the way the seminar went. Have you ever heard of such
classism?
Thing?
You mean by
science.
Transplants and get a new heart, get a new liver, and keep
that
going?
Science can do.
And even if not forever, let's say 200 years.
Well,
even that would be an ethical question.
Of course, the millennium, you know, is how time. But Dan said that he said the man was like 50-some years old, he looked like he was in his 30s. They said with all the scientific things, does that sound?
Well, I'm only in my 20s, so. They, what I understand, and not an expert in these kinds of issues, but what I understand is that the majority of people feel that scientists that deal with these kinds of issues think, well, yeah, we might be able to get another 10 or 20 years off the normal lifespan, but probably not more than that. We have, in our genetic makeup, we have something called programmed cell death. The scientific term for it is apoptosis. And when our cells replicate, the chromosomes are shortened a little bit each time. And it's the way the replication of DNA works. So a little bit doesn't get copied at the end. And so the ends of our chromosomes get a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller, until they get to a point that they destroy a vital gene, and then that cell dies. And all of our cells are doing this. There is a way to prevent it. And what we have been finding is that if you look at tumor cells and cancerous malignant cells, those cells have this sort of repair mechanism, and therefore they continue to grow, and that's what produces tumors. And so trying to correct this problem probably would be a cancer-producing activity. So I'm not. That's my sense of things, and I'm not saying that's gospel, but that's my sense of things from what I've read. Is that sure because of what we can do? I have a son that puts in so many artificial knees and hips. It's amazing, you know, how we can keep dealing with those issues and transplants, like you mentioned. But still, at some point, the way our cells divide is probably not going to happen.
I had a rhetorical question. I wonder if we would grant, assuming that the goal is to extend life into some, you know, higher number than God has currently given us, if we would be willing and desirous of that feature for all of life on the planet. I mean, if we're going to do it for ourselves, let's, you know, let's let the grizzlies live longer. Let's let the chickens live longer. And, you know,
flock, flock.
There you go.
One thing that strikes me, it's part of the debate that goes on now, it's like people make the assumption that they have no control over technology. And I mean, I think people can accept or deny the use of technology in a lot of different ways. And one of the disturbing things is society's sticking their nose into people's private business about their use of technology.
Yeah.
Terry Schiavo is probably the best example. A mockery of what should have been a very private decision, in my opinion. Those are, I think, really important issues about the use of technology.
Yeah.
Just kind of counterpart to Dorothy, most of you know Eric in the village. If you don't yet, you haven't been in the pool hall. His issues are genetics, and when I got pregnant after him, amniocentesis was something that was offered to us, and with some good counseling, we chose to go ahead with it, knowing the results didn't preclude what we would do with the results. I think the reality is because I deal in a community with many people that have children with disabilities, these are questions we talk about all the time.
Yes.
One of Eric's best friends was the first of what has now become a generation of kids that survived with his spine open at the base of his skull. And as his mom so delicately put sometimes, well, his brain just kind of slid down into his shoulder. But the reality is, before Michael was born, kids like that didn't survive. But because there is modern technology, the disabilities that are out there right now are more than just club feet. They're very serious disabilities, and our society has not begun to deal with the fact that just because we can save these neonates, that should we be? Michael has some pretty severe disabilities. Now, we know him as Michael, and we wouldn't trade him. And his mom wouldn't go back and say, well, I shouldn't have let him survive. But the reality is it takes a tremendous amount of resources. And I think as a society, the question of the resources we put into saving one neonate, can you use those same resources to do prenatal care for how many thousands of women? But I think our technology has always outstripped what our ethics are. You can go back to vaccines. I mean, we don't want to do technology. Well, I mean, in some ways, I mean, it goes back hundreds of years. But I think there are questions that need to be grappled with, and not just the genetics, although that becomes where my interest is always.
Yes, no, that's very good. Yeah, so, yeah.
Thank you, that's a great illustration.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Right.
One thing that's been in the news more recently, I heard, is that they're gonna be able to do testing within the first couple weeks of pregnancy and determine the sex. And they're concerned right now is, will people be choosing the sex of the child that they want and all? One way or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's another moral dilemma.
This may steer the discussion away from the center point, but my immediate family, I have a nephew who is 15 now, has not lived a day in his life without 24 a day nursing care. Mm-hmm. In a lot of other circumstances too. Mm-hmm. There's, like we said, a tremendous amount of medical resources and human resources in family and community dedicated just to Peter's survival.
Yeah.
But I think in the bigger picture of things, we've got the same question to wrestle with in access to basic health care through society. Where, in my viewpoint, I live in a rural community adjacent to a major metro area, but we are rapidly getting to the point where we're going to have the haves and the have-nots as far as access or resources to tap the medical care that's available.
Mm-hmm.
And who makes the decision as to what's appropriate, what's economical, what's practical, what's morally right? I see that as a basic dilemma, even though this is making headlines.
Yeah.
That's a great example, and it raises a whole other question, who will make the decisions, like we saw in the Terry Schiavo case.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A I'll give you a different spin. My father is 97. He still drives and drives well. He does crossword puzzles that I can't begin to do. And he walks slowly, but he's in good health, except that his bone marrow has stopped making red blood cells. So for about 3 years now, he has to go in about every 4 months and have a blood transfusion that lasts all day. And he carries great guilt that Medicare would spend this money on him when there are, you know, he's Norwegian and Lutheran. So when there are other people who deserve and need this money and these resources put towards their health, and it's public health, it's general health, and it's general access to healthcare for everybody. So there's all levels of another illustration of who makes these decisions. Yeah.
Mark. I'll complexify it even further and add to what my wife said about our experience. Another dimension of our discussion was that what could happen, that hasn't already, is that insurers are going to begin to say, and some have, look, if you're in a position to know something, let's say that you're carrying a child with Tay-Sachs, and you elect not to have that knowledge, you preclude the possibility of doing something about that, i.e. aborting the child, and if you therefore A, choose not to know, or B, find out but then elect not to abort, then you are implicated in now having a child that costs a tremendous amount of money in terms of that medical. See what I'm saying?
Yep.
So the pressures here are extremely, extremely complicated then, because now suddenly the decision not to know, which is, I think, pretty much cuts against the grain of just popular wisdom, is if you can know something, you should know it, right? We elected not to know something, but it's not clear that other people are going to have that option very long and be insured if the child is born in any way abnormal.
Wow, and then, so once you know, then you have to act a certain way according to what you know too as well. That's great, yeah, Dave?
I thought about that guy living forever. You know, my issue is really about people should live forever, but this thing about money getting in the way of having equal health and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
All that thing about is my lifespan, living healthy in later years, and maybe, living longer, not living only 60 years, maybe 100 years or something, but probably long enough lifespan, that's a pretty good length. But, what I want to see is more equal treatment of medical and also better health in later years, until they pass away. Yeah, I do believe in the Bible about, Hebrews 9:27, we're appointed a month in terms of judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. And you mentioned the word earlier, just as you walked in, about your word was classism, that the rich can do this, but as you said, who's going to get to do this? Good.
God wants people to help for a new way.
Yep. Thank you. Yes.
A lot of these issues have been raised that are really complex for me, and they're really interesting. I was going to return to one that, for me at least, is not as hard. I think maybe I'm just not seeing the complexity of it, and that is the issue regarding, I guess this goes to Emily's father, the therapeutic cloning. And I guess I support it. I think it's a marvelous potential medical breakthrough. This work is being done. It's going to happen whether the U.S. government supports it or not. It will happen in other countries. And I'm just struggling with, and I'm sure there are really good ones. What is the strong argument against therapeutic cloning? I understand the argument against reproductive cloning, and I'm there. I'm there on that. But therapeutic cloning, to me, seems to have so few downsides. But obviously, people don't agree on that, and so I'd just be interested to hear what the other side is. What is the concern that people have regarding therapeutic cloning?
Is it the source of those cells, Grant? Maybe where they get them from?
Well, there are basically three places to get them. You can get them from very early miscarriages. The majority of those cells, up to this point, have come from in vitro fertilization, where a woman is treated to multiply ovulate and maybe will produce 10 to 12 eggs, and they all are fertilized with sperm and begin to undergo development. And by the way, at the up to about the 8-cell stage in the petri dish, you can tease out a cell from that growing embryo. Those 7 cells will produce a baby, no problem. But you can test that 8th cell. And so you can test it for a variety of conditions at that early stage. Well, let's say that's done, and here are 3 embryos that seem to be free of potential problems. They get implanted back into the mother, and maybe one of them will take and she'll bear a child, maybe all 3, and she'll have triplets. But there may be 8 or 9 left. Okay. And so those leftover embryos are one of the sources of stem cells through therapeutic cloning. I mean, you let those continue. They're being frozen if they're not being used for anything else at this point in this country. And the third one is that you make them on purpose. You know, you produce them for the purpose of cloning. I mean, you do that from scratch. By the way, just to follow up a little bit on what Dan mentioned, he said it's going to be done somewhere, whether it's done here or not. The same laboratory that produced Dolly the sheep has now been licensed this spring by the government of Great Britain to go into to produce human clones for therapeutic cloning for stem cell production. They have the license to do that right now. They not only cloned Dolly the sheep, they made some other advances prior to that. There is a claim within the last month, I think if I remember the dates right, that South Korea is producing embryonic stem cells for therapeutic cloning. So there's 2 countries where it's being done. Okay. Here, there is, by presidential executive order, there can be no funding, federal funding, for stem cell production, embryonic stem cells. Therapeutic cloning cannot be funded by the federal government by executive order of President Bush that he made in 2000.
Is that because of the source of those cells? I mean, I'm still after Peter's question, or Dan's question. What is it they're against? Where those cells come from? Is that what you're asking? Or?
I'm wondering what the argument is against
that. Yeah, and is that it? How these,
it gets pulled into the whole discussion of abortion.
Yes, yeah. That's the main.
Yeah. Right.
If life begins at conception, then you would be taking a human life to life.
Yeah. Using human life. That's what I hear when I try and have conversations with people about, you know, what's the difference between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning, and do you understand that difference? And the major objection that I hear is that, well, it doesn't matter how you create it or what it is. If it's, you know, if you have fertilization, if you have more than one cell there at conception, it's a life. And so we can't just be experimenting willy-nilly, these crazy scientists, mutating people to do whatever they want with, kind of attitude.
But the frozen embryos, I mean, what's going to happen with those frozen embryos?
They're going to be stored indefinitely until the freezer gets unplugged.
Well, there was a woman in the Seattle papers who gave birth to one of those embryos. She felt that she wanted to rescue these little frozen embryos,
oh,
who she considered as children.
So not hers.
Not hers at all. Hmm. But just to prevent their destruction, like these were all little frozen people. Mm-hmm. And so she actually had one implanted and was a child and was not. That's a very strong feeling.
Mm-hmm. To add to the conversation about resources, I mean, what resources are we spending on indefinitely freezing all these embryos that aren't going to get used that could be used for other purposes?
Is private industry stepping in and doing anything?
Well, it's too risky.
Not to my knowledge, I haven't seen anything about that. So, you know, whether any of the biotechnology companies right. have done this at this point. Four states in the union allow a funding, state funding, for embryonic stem cell production. And
you talked about those.
Yes.
Illinois, Wisconsin,
California, and Massachusetts. Was that the fourth one?
But it's small. It's small but change. It's chump change compared to.
Yeah, one has a lot. I think one of those states has permitted that to happen in their state, but they haven't allocated the funds yet. Mm-hmm. And I think that California allocated some small amount, like $2 million or something. It was relatively small.
Does anybody else have a story? I mean, I think they're legion, I would think, of how we are directly or maybe just indirectly affected by this, whether it's a story like we've heard or a dad who thinks he doesn't deserve to.
I don't have a story. I have a question, which is, have we heard anything from the ELCA on their commentary or what kind of position is being taken?
I don't know.
I don't think I've heard anything.
There are a few denominations that have, one way or the other. I mean, the Mormons have made a statement.
Have.
But Episcopal?
No, we haven't yet. we let anything happen. You know, remember that. You know, there are no bounds in the Episcopal Church. You can be way over here or way over here.
Not in the middle, though.
Not.
I think there are studies going on.
They're Roman Catholics, yeah. I'll have a resource story. It's an old story, but it's just another example of limited resources. When I began teaching at Willamette, the chairman of our department, who was retired 2 years after I got there, his wife had kidney disease. She was 64, I believe. She was in her early 60s and required dialysis. There was a finite number of dialysis machines in 1968 or 9, whatever it was, when this happened. And she was denied dialysis because there were not enough dialysis machines in Oregon to satisfy the needs of dialysis patients. And the decision by whoever would be in the medical community that controlled who had access to dialysis machines said, you lived your life. We have people early that are much younger that will be able to be productive citizens in the future. And she was denied dialysis and died because of it. You know? And because there weren't the resources, it was physical resources in this case. But monetary same there. Interesting stuff. Sad.
That wouldn't happen today, would it?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Not with dialysis.
No, with dialysis. But with some of these other
issues. But almost with that, no matter what, there would be something.
Well, but financial resources, we're a little different down in Oregon, and some of you may know more about this than I do, or Oregonians. But you know, we have a different relationship with the federal government compared to Medicaid. We have what's called the Oregon Health Plan. Our previous governor was actually an emergency room physician and wrote a way of rationing, essentially, health care. And it amounts to, here's a list of conditions. They don't take into consideration the age of the patient or any of those like they did for Dorothy Monk in 1968 or 9. But here are a list of conditions. We can afford to fund the first however many. We draw a line. Anybody that has one of these conditions and is Medicaid eligible, it's not Medicare, Medicaid, is out of luck.
Well, it's not just what's treated, it's how it's treated. That's why it's on the other hand. If you have certain allergies or aspirin, there are only certain drugs they will cover, whether regardless of how you respond to some of the newer stuff out there or don't respond to other things. That they decide how you're
going to
be treated.
Aren't there people who might choose or not to have dialysis because to them that procedure is, to them, something like
that. Oh, sure. People
decide that some they don't want to go.
Yeah, people refuse medical treatment. Nobody's forcing them.
Any other thoughts?
I can put those questions.
Yeah,
right,
let's go to those questions. We'll just go through them one at a time. And if anybody has a thought, we'll share it. You share it. And if not, we'll move to the next
Actually,
one.
If you could just reach out and hit the space bar on the keyboard, it probably will come back.
And if you're new to forums, we stop at an hour, so that gives us 15 minutes to cover these. So prioritize your questions.
There they are. Thank you.
I'm also interested in the role of gender in all of these questions and how people, different sexes, look at these questions. So I'm just going to toss that up there.
Yeah, good.
We have a psychologist in the room who could write a questionnaire.
I just listen. Got back from 3 weeks in China, and they know, you all know how they would answer that question. From the one child. What is normals? You can read them. Do you have a thought about any of those that we would share?
Well, I know a lot of deaf people don't really consider themselves disabled. They consider themselves another culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that would be, you might consider it a disability. Mm-hmm.
Did everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
No. Let's repeat that.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to say that there are many deaf people who do not consider themselves disabled. And they refer to themselves as the deaf with a capital D, and it's another culture. And they're quite proud of who
yeah.
they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been examples, haven't there, of families who could restore hearing to their children and chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
Should be in error two.
Yeah.
The ELCA now too is, the ELCA with its youth conventions now has, instead of talking about disabled people, they actually have a pre-assembly for differently abled
mm-hmm.
people. So even the name that we give or the label that we put on, for instance, deaf people, disability doesn't apply in their own identifying of themselves. It's not a disability. It doesn't exclude them from something. It is a differently abled thing. I think that label itself is something that goes into this question.
And how does that jive with things like the American Disabilities Act?
Yeah,
right here.
It would be a positive image about lifespan again.
You're on the floor.
You know, I was mentioning that earlier. I read stuff in the Old Testament about 120 years and stuff. So I think 120 years would be a good lifespan.
Yeah, we'd probably all be happy with that.
I got Old Testament talk about 120 years. So that's a good basis there.
Sure. Thank you.
I guess to me this first question kind of speaks to the great fear that I think is behind some of the concerns about things, which is, genetic engineering, the belief that somehow with just enough science we can eliminate, these kinds of problems and dysfunction and create perfect human beings.
Yeah,
and it seems, and that, I mean, I'm one of the scared people about that, because it seems like various attempts in history to have perfect human beings have been, horrible. And so it's just, I know that there have been circumstances in my own life that I had a particular opinion about something that I strongly held, for example, in terms of medical euthanasia. I really had a very strong opinion against intentional ending life until I began to know people, in particular circumstances where indeed, with great care, it seemed like the most compassionate and just thing to happen but then it's over against, well, but what if we start euthanizing people that are inconvenient, unproductive, demanding resources? And that is definitely within our means right now, but on the creative side, you know, that's what is seen as the consequence of further development. And I don't, it always, for me, it seems like when it comes to the personal question, then what I think of as sort of a moral principle gets changed somehow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By the compassion of a circumstance. And so I it's not as though I have a position or a thought, but it just seems like that's really where the challenge is how do you make a decision, whether it's you yourself, as we've had in some of these examples, or how we as a church or as a nation make decisions that you know, open up all kinds of possibility that benefit some tremendously, are clearly a positive step, but always have the underside of these could be used for very destructive purposes.
That sure puts a complicated framework around who decides, mm-hmm. how we arrive, how we decide who decides.
I think an underlying piece in what you've just said, also you mentioned fear, and I think one of the great fears that drives some of what maybe might be considered the more frivolous uses of this is the fear of someone who is other than I am. So that we have to eliminate all these people who aren't normal. I think that's a fear in this science that somehow if we get rid of anybody who is different, differently abled, different colored, different gender, different whatever, then we'll have a perfect society. And there is a little bit of that in this conversation, I think, that if we can just modify our genes just right, everything will be great because there won't be anybody who's different. And that is what I'm afraid of, is living in a culture where no one is different. Because
and we already have that issue in plant life, mm-hmm. where through genetic engineering you get a perfect hardy plant, mm-hmm. etc. You know, but one of the consequences of that is that the spread of that is now beginning to eliminate diversity, mm-hmm. even unintentionally. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
One of the things that I always think about with these kinds of questions is, you know, as we've expanded our range about where things come from and things we purchase, we try to avoid sweatshop clothing, we purchase fair trade coffee, etc. And one of the things that I think about in this, the fact of this kind of medical stuff being possible, is that all of this research is done on animals, and which is, I'm completely opposed to animal testing, and it really, for me, it's a very much of a religious thing. I feel that it is not, I don't feel it's humans' place on the planet to subvert God's will for an animal, and not to mention cause it suffering and cruelty, which to live in a lab setting is, and conduct all kinds of tests and experiments, and etc. I just don't see how that is doing justice, you know, walking kindly and really honoring and loving creation. And so when I think about what it takes to get to the all of this stuff so that we can have these very privileged resources, I'm not saying, anyway, for me, if I look at that as, you know, if we jump over the moral steps on a very one-on-one individual basis to leap to the justification for this other thing. And I think it's important to look back at where, how this thing has become available to us. So that is something that I'm after.
You just added another layer of complexity to the whole thing. And then the people that would argue, you know, Kyle versus Emily's dad. It really is a complex, when it gets personal, I'm just saying that now we've got the theory, and we've got the as Diane talked about, the theory and then the personal. Yeah?
I need to ask a question. I have a little card that says in case of my death, they're supposed to notify this 800 number immediately because they want my body as soon as possible before it gets cold. And they're going to take it and do it, use whatever they want to of it, and then cremate the rest of it. Have I done the wrong thing? Doing that? That's what they use for research and that kind of thing, isn't it?
Right. What they use in medical schools.
Sure. In medical
very important medical schools. Schools. And it's becoming more and more of a problem is getting individuals to donate bodies.
That's a good thing to do, and you don't have any costs for your children, don't have to worry about your remains or anything. That's great.
I mean, do you want to be the first patient that some surgeon operates on? Because there has been only TV simulations up to that point, because there are no cadavers to work on. I think you want somebody who's.
I live to be this old and.
No, I'm saying without people like you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then that would result in a situation where the first time a surgeon might open up somebody to do a repair on might be the first time he's actually ever seen or she has actually ever seen a real liver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
it's wonderful.
Drugs of any kind. If I'm lucky enough to die before I have to take any drugs, well, I think they'll be glad that
my one of my grandfathers donated his body to the University of Washington Medical School, and at some point after he did that, they said, thanks a lot, but no thanks, you're too old. And then he got to be into his 90s, and they changed their mind again, because now they had somebody who was 95, 96 years old, which they don't have many at all.
Good. The complexity gets better. Yeah.
This is a different side of things. When I think about the what is a disability or disorder thing, and would we change that or treat that, the one thing that maybe people can correct me, because maybe this I'm not so up on my science, but like when Ingrid Christiansen's here, a lot of those, she's talking about, she works with people on death row, and but one of her clients just had, it was like a psychological issue, which I think is genetic sometimes, right? Like that there's some things where like, for whatever reason, he needed to do something and he ended up stabbing a woman and her baby in the mall because of this mental issue, that he had, that was what he had to do then. And so now she's in the process of like writing a defense for his story. And so when I think about people who commit crimes, not because, of poverty or culture or nurture or the way that they've been raised, but because there's something psychologically wrong that results in rape or murder or things like that, that's when, to me, it's really tempting, like personally tempting, to say like I don't know, like that would be pretty interesting to be able to at least be able to test that. And so even if the person wasn't reborn, that we would be able to monitor that person, and that those kind of violent crimes, like that aren't the cause of what we're creating here, but something biological. I don't know. I think in that case, I would be for it.
Check this guy out.
Yeah. Okay, now that's exactly the sort of thing that I mean, because to genetically manipulate that you could eliminate this problem also means that you could create it and develop people prone to violence and murder without the ability to have conscience. And so that's what I mean there. You got the underside.
Has anybody else attended Grant's classes and just wondered? I have off and on. What if Hitler had a hold of this stuff?
Yeah.
I saw him. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I was just sitting here listening to the discussion and the opportunity to have a sharing of ideas like this in this kind of a setting is so limited, and yet these issues seem to get decided by political action committees and politics at its worst. And so it becomes a question, how the heck do you create forums to have a discussion like this? Because it seems a lot of these ought to be decided by close relatives or informed people or affected people. And, you know, the Supreme Court's going to hear Oregon's assisted suicide law. And you kind of wonder how that's going to go. And there was a recent article in the Oregonian about a woman who decided just to stop taking food and water and end her life that way, and with dignity as far as she was concerned, and nobody's challenged that because I guess there aren't drugs involved. But it's a real difficult forum to have any kind of a discussion.
It took her longer to die than she ever expected, too.
Pardon me?
No, I'm saying it would take a while.
Okay, well, let's go two more if we have that, and then we'll wind up.
I appreciate all the levels of complications in the whole discussion here, and yet when we get right down to it, the $64 question is going to be who decides? Mm-hmm. Whatever question you're addressing here on the screen. And I think we've gotten ourselves in a society that has an inherent distrust in most technology and most opinions. We're a society of sound bites. We don't take the time to understand. I've learned a ton here tonight, and I'm involved in production agriculture. And I wrestle with the idea that most people now don't have a direct connection with where the food comes from or farm anymore. And yet we're trying to tell our story in sound bites, and basically, in most cases, we're misunderstood. When you've got terms like Frankenfood out there and that sort of discussion. So I think myself, I'm not sure that we'll ever get the best decision if it's made in the public arena. And that's a scary thought also. But we've got a society that isn't going to take the time to understand all the complexities of the issue and educate themselves and make an intelligent decision. We've got state houses that aren't doing it.
But one of the great things about I hate to be an apologist for America. One of the great things about America, okay, there's so many different publics. I mean, so you've got scientists working on this, and then you've got politicians, and not all politicians think alike. So it seems to me, I mean, I guess I'm responding, Paul, to your question about, you know, what if Hitler got a hold of this or something. I mean, I don't think that's likely. I mean, it seems to me that in a society like ours, there's so many competing factors that in a way that's kind of good. Because, all right, so President Bush isn't providing money for stem cell research. I think he should, if he doesn't, okay. But then the states step up, or Korea steps up, and they're doing this work. Now, some people don't think it's good work to do. And so, you know, maybe they don't like to see that. But things eventually do get decided, it seems to me. And there's lots of different ways. And so I'm not too worried that, you know, some big force is going to come in and just, like, tell us all what to do. I guess I have more faith in the idea that, you know, decisions there will be opportunities to make decisions, and I'm not that scared about this. I think some of these are very interesting questions, but I mean, some of the things that technology is doing these days in medicine are potentially great breakthroughs, and if they can extend the life of people who are differently abled, but whose different abilities are disabling as well, and improve their lives, I think that it's hard for me to argue against that kind of thing. So I guess I'm more optimistic and less scared about this than I thought I might be.
Thank you. Maybe we end with, because we are at that time, that one of the great things about Holden is that if you've picked up a model for a forum, take it home. And you've got congregations, you've got schools, you've got institutions you work with. And there are people who work on the outside of institutions and are affected. And there are people who work within institutions who are effective, and wherever you are, take home a Holden forum. But thank you very much.